We've seen a wave of Republicans that have been elected across the states in the last decade, and they are making a huge difference. We're living in one of those states in North Carolina where a decade ago, a little over, it was dominated by Democratic politics, and now the Republican Party leads in this state of North Carolina. Dan Forrest is only the second Republican lieutenant governor to be elected in the history of North Carolina. And after the 2016 election, he became the first Republican in the state's history to be reelected to office. As Lieutenant Governor, Dan serves as the president of the North Carolina Senate and a voting member of the State Board of Education and the State Board of Community Colleges. He is also a member of the North Carolina Advisory Commission on Military Affairs, the chair of the Energy Policy Council, and the Food Manufacturing Task Force. After receiving 2 degrees from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, Dan became a leader in the business community for over 20 years, having served as office president and senior partner of the state's largest architectural firm, Little Diversity Architectural Consulting. Dan has been designated as an architect emeritus. As a father of four, he and his wife Alice reside in Raleigh. But Dan is leading the conservative effort here in North Carolina, and I've worked with him over the last 10 years, in particular as the North Carolina legislature took a stand against the liberal government in Charlotte on what you might recall the bathroom bill, which the Obama administration, then pushing back, began to impose that on the entire nation through the elementary schools and junior highs and so forth, and colleges. Dan has traveled the country helping other state legislatures fight back against the overreach of the federal government. He does amazing work here. He is a great friend and leader in the conservative movement, and so grateful to have him here today with us as we begin our general session. He has been helping push back on the narrative to the business community that conservative politics is bad for business, because North Carolina has a booming economy, and Dan has been traveling the country to tell that story. Please help me welcome the Lieutenant Governor of the state of North Carolina, Dan Forrest.
Thank you all. Thank you very much. I'm going to start my speech with demanding an FBI investigation into whoever put me on the stage right after Nikki Haley. And I think it was Tony Perkins. And Tony, we used to be friends, but we're not anymore. But it is truly an honor to be here with you. And there's so many friends in this audience and folks that I've known for a long time that have supported us right here in North Carolina through thick and thin. It's an honor to be here with you, and it's an honor to be in battle with you as well. And we've been in battle together for some time. It seems like North Carolina is like the tip of the spear for so many of the crazy things that the left wants to try out, and they want to start here. But before I move on, I just want to say, you know, as a group, as a body, I would just like to ask all of us to remember to pray for your leaders, especially folks like Nikki Haley. I mean, think of how long that we have wanted somebody like, prayed for somebody like Nikki Haley to be at the UN, to do what she's doing in the way she does it, and she does it with intelligence, she does it with grace, and she does it with power. And we should all be very thankful for the job she does, and we should remember to keep her in our prayers. And I want to say welcome. Raise your hand if you're from North Carolina. Let's start there. Small group, there we go, of our North Carolina friends. For those of you who are not from North Carolina, what are you waiting for? You can still come here. We still have room, not much room. We still have a little bit left. So welcome to the great state of North Carolina. And, you know, we have, like I said, fought some battles, and I fought some with Tony as well. Tony was right here by our side through thick and thin, working with me, working with our General Assembly, working with Tammy Fitzgerald, who's here in the audience with the North Carolina Values Coalition, who's fought so hard as well. And we've kind of been partners in this battle, this bathroom battle, the marriage battle before that, and we'll be partners in the battles going forward. But I also had the privilege of sitting next to Tony and working with Tony when we went down to Texas. Anybody from Texas? Here we are. All right. We love Texas. We had the privilege of going and testifying before your Senate in Texas when Texas was fighting the bathroom insanity of the left. And I remember I got off the plane and I went straight to the Capitol, and Dan Patrick, Lieutenant Governor, was there to meet me. And we walk right into the Capitol and he says, "Come on, we're going to a press conference." And I'm like, "I don't even know what we're doing," but we go to a press conference and he says, "You're in charge of this one." And I didn't even know what the topic was, right? I mean, I knew where they were talking about bathrooms. So we get in there, and in Texas fashion, in Texas style, there's about 50, 60, 75 cameras lined up. All the media in Texas is there. And Dan turns over the microphone and says, "I want to introduce the Lieutenant Governor of North Carolina." And I got up and I talked about the narrative, the truth of the narrative, what was going on in North Carolina. And I talked about it in a way that they had never heard before. They had their questions planned. They had their narrative lined up. They knew how they were going to attack the members of the General Assembly in Texas. And they knew what the media narrative was going to be. We finished a 15-minute press conference. The media did not have one question. They packed up their stuff and they walked away. And Dan Patrick, to his credit, said, "I've been doing this a long time, and the media has never not had a question before. It's the first time I've ever seen that." And I want to say that to say that it's incumbent upon us, right, as conservatives, to understand what we're fighting for and to understand how to defend what we're fighting for as well. That's one of our great challenges. We may be passionate about the issues, but when push comes to shove, when the camera's in your face and the media is all over you, how do you respond and how do you defend? And how do you go on the offensive? And so we have some folks here in the audience that you can certainly learn from. I saw my good friend and apologist, Frank Turek, who wrote the book, "I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist." He's here in the room with us. Jeff Myers from Summit Ministries is here too, I think. I have some other dear friends like John Stone Street, Colson Center. And I rely on those resources, as you should too, to be able to apologetically defend the things that we believe. And so that being said, we did all that in Texas. And while all that craziness was going on, the media narrative was, if you don't support this leftist agenda, your economy is going to fall apart. In North Carolina, people are, they're leaving in droves. Companies are packing up and leaving North Carolina, and the tourism is going to shut down. You know, the NBA is pulling out, the NCAA is pulling out. Well, the truth of the matter was, during that period of time, that 1 year period that we were fighting that battle, our economy was the strongest it had ever been. The strongest it had ever been. And our GDP was the highest it had ever been. Our per capita income was the highest it had ever been. Our tourism was the highest it had ever been. And the media did this. They actually fact-checked this because I did a story on it, but they fact-checked this, that the financial impact of North Carolina of HB2 over that period of time was 0.5% of our annual GDP. So where did you ever hear that in the media? You never hear these narratives. So these insane things from the left, if they haven't come to your state, they're coming to your state. And you need to gather around the big brains that are in this room, the think tanks that are in this room, the organizations that are going to fight those things, and gather them around you because we have to figure out a strategy to win. Now, while we're in the middle of that as well, I wanted to give kudos to Tony. I'm not sure where Tony went. He's backstage, I guess. But while we're in the middle of that, and people were pulling out their conventions, they were saying their concerts were leaving and their conventions were leaving North Carolina, CNP decided to sign up for this event that we're having right now in Charlotte, North Carolina. So thank you, CNP, for doing that. And you can tell by the traffic and the activity in a place like Charlotte, our economy is certainly not hurting. I grew up in a political family, and my mother was actually mayor of this city. She was the first female mayor of Charlotte, and she went on to serve in Congress for a long time. And I remember growing up in a political family and actually hating politics. I didn't hate it. I just didn't want anything to do with it. I never wanted to serve in the political world. And I remember one time, you know, a long time ago, 30 years ago, and saying to my wife, because people would always ask me, "Are you going to get in politics? Are you going to follow your mother's footsteps?" I said, "No way. I see the impact that it has on families. I know how tough it is. I know what a sacrifice it is. There's no bright, shiny object out there." Just like Nikki Haley said, she knows she's getting up every day and she's fighting a battle. She just doesn't know what the battle's going to be. Most people don't have to live that life, but I didn't want to have anything to do with that life. And I remember saying to my wife at the time, I said, "You know, I don't want to do it. But if God ever calls me to get engaged in politics, I have this just really deep-seated feeling that it's going to be a much tougher time in America than it is today." And that was 30 years ago, and about 10 years ago, I made this decision. I felt called to step into this role and run for lieutenant governor. And even then, That was even before we were fighting battles like a marriage amendment here, determining if marriage really was about the union between one man and one woman created by God, something we've believed throughout from the beginning of time. And we started to fight that battle. And then we started to fight this battle over bathrooms, which was really this battle over gender. I mean, who knew we were going to be fighting a battle trying to determine how many genders there are in America? And if somebody can change their gender throughout the day 20 times and then decide where they go into a bathroom or where they go into a shower or how they act, I mean, who knew, right? We can't make this stuff up. And so I knew at that time that times were changing in America. We've seen it. We've seen it rapidly decline. And, you know, I'd never imagined that a single individual, Barack Obama, could fundamentally transform the United States of America in 8 years. Can you imagine one individual fundamentally transforming the United States? And so we find ourselves here, and we're not just dealing with bathroom issues or gender issues or marriage issues, but identity politics. Risen to a level, to an extreme, to a fever pitch that we have never seen in America before, maybe not anywhere else in the world, to where rule of law doesn't matter, to where non-government organizations have authority over government and citizens and people that we've never seen before, to Supreme Court nominations going astray that amount to little more than character assassination, where it's not just about stopping a nomination, not just about ruining somebody's career, it's about ruining somebody's entire life. And so we have a battle on our hands that is very different than it was when I was a kid, or when you were a kid. You know, I remember when I was a kid, I gathered my friends up from the neighborhood, we'd get on our bikes, and, you know, we didn't even have helmets at the time, right? We'd ride around, we'd ride all over town all day long. As long as we were home by dark, it was fine. We'd fall off our bikes, we'd have bruises and cuts, and nobody got sued. Remember those days? We'd go to those playgrounds with the really high swings where you thought if you could get going high enough, maybe you could do a loop around the swing, and sometimes you fell off backwards and landed on your back, and nobody got sued. You remember that? And those big slides, the big metal slides, y'all remember those? Those were great. And on a hot day, you'd burn your butt, you know, going down if you had shorts on. Or the merry-go-rounds where you'd stick your friend in the middle and you'd get it going as fast as you could and they'd fly off into the dirt. You know, and when we were doing those things, nobody was looking at the government to say, how are we going to ask the government how to regulate these things? You know, this is really dangerous. And now we find ourselves in this world where we have safe spaces for our college adults. They're not college kids, by the way. They're college adults. Our safe spaces are free speech zones. You know, it's a very different world. Back in that world when I was a kid, I don't even remember asking my neighbors or even my parents asking them, are you a Democrat or a Republican or an independent? Are you libertarian? Are you Protestant or are you Catholic or are you Jewish? We just kind of hung out together and we did life together. And I think it was a better time in America. I'm not one to say that there were the good old days, but I think there was a simpler time in our country, a time where our kids were free to run around. They were free to roam. They were free to be kids in America. And it was a safer, simpler time. And obviously that was a day before a government controlled everything, even especially the way that we play and the way that we do life. I think it's not just the fact that the state is at the center of our lives. I don't think that's really the fact. I think the fact is that we have come to believe that that's the way it's supposed to be, and we've come to accept it and say, well, as you talk to your friends and I do mine, that's just the way it is in America today. That's not just the way it is in America today. That's not the way it's supposed to be in America today. And we can turn America around. We have the ability to turn it around. And so, as author and sociologist Jocko Lull says in one of his books, he says, we increasingly turn to the state for solutions to every problem, though the state cannot solve them if they tried. Lull says this leads to three evils: boundless inflation of the state's size and power, increasing dependence upon the state, and decreasing control over it by the people or the politicians that are supposedly in control of it. So by giving the state more power and acting like they have more power and acting like they can solve the problems, it's actually just the opposite is what happens in reality. And I think even politicians get into the game, and you know this, right? Politicians in your state, politicians in my state, run for office, we're doing it right now. Here we are, we find ourselves in the same position again. We need to cut government spending. We need to defund Planned Parenthood. We need to We need to get rid of Obamacare. Promises, 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 promises. Yes, we need to do those things, but let's go do them. When we're in control, we must do them. But if we keep sending back people to Congress that continue to make the same promises and continue to not deliver, guess what? It's the definition of insanity. We're going to continue to get the same thing. It's our job. It's incumbent upon us to make sure that we put good people like Nikki Haley in positions of power so that they can truly have influence on the world around us. And if we don't do that, we're going to continue on the same path that we're on today. And so politics has become a religion to many, and I think it's a religion especially to those on the left. We're in danger on the right as well, but it's become a religion to those on the left. And just look how passionately obsessed people are. How passionately obsessed. These are things that used to only reach fever pitches and even in religious battles, but we see it every day in our lives of picking a Supreme Court nominee, climate change, gun control, Black Lives Matter, all these things that are elevated to a pitch that we've never seen. Kids marching in the streets after gun violence, they're marching in the streets telling the government to take away their Second Amendment rights to defend themselves. We see that all over America. And so all eyes are kind of focused on us right now. I believe all over the world, they're focused on America. Is America what we have said it is to the world for the last 200 plus years? Is America the last best hope? What are we going to do? How are we going to react and respond? I think all eyes are on us. And I think we also know that politics is not the answer. Politics is one of the solutions, but politics is so far downstream of culture. It is so far downstream of culture. By the time it gets to politics, we're reactionary. What do we do in the meantime? How do we cast a vision? How do we build into our culture upstream so that we can see the right effects downstream politically? And so I think that if we're going to change America and we're going to see freedom flourish, that we must change people's hearts, not grow government. We must change people's hearts and not grow government. We don't have a government problem. We have a heart problem. You know, I'm reminded of we heard it from Ronald Reagan, but it's much older than that. The imagery of the shining city upon a hill. Probably every politician along the way or every president has used this image of the shining city upon a hill. John Winthrop used it on the Arbella when he was coming over to the new country, and he was telling his people, we have this opportunity to be something different. We have this opportunity, my friends, to be a shining city upon a hill. And they were talking about the hill of Boston off in the distance, and they could see it. And it wasn't about the buildings they were going to build on that hill. It wasn't about beautiful buildings. It was about beautiful people. And this notion of the shining city upon a hill, we remember where it comes from. It comes from the words of Jesus. And Jesus said, you are to be salt and light. You are to be like a shining city upon a hill. And we are not to hide our light under a basket where people cannot see it. We're to shine our light into culture. And we have been guilty, my friends. We've been guilty of hiding our light for many decades. Our light has been hidden to the world, and that's why we're facing the challenges that we're facing right now. Winthrop went on to say, he said, they're creating this new community that would set an example of communal charity, affection, and unity to the world, or if the Puritans failed to uphold their covenant to God, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world of God's judgment. And I think that's where we find ourselves in America today, on the precipice of becoming a story and a byword, not America, not the world's last best hope any longer, but a story and a byword. And so this city upon a hill, being salt and light into our communities. And so while we fight this battle, while we think about how do we do this? How do we go out and fight this battle? Again, I want to kind of conjure up some biblical imagery. And I think of the book of Kings, 2 Kings, I think it's chapter 6, in Elisha, the prophet Elisha, who is really irritating the enemy king. He's been irritating the enemy king for a long time, and the enemy king is going out to try to kill him, and he wants to find him and track him down. He finally finds out where Elisha is. He sends his entire army overnight in the dark of night to set up camp against Elisha's army. And they're in this town called Dothan, and it's actually a town in a valley, but it's surrounded, almost encircled by mountains. And Elisha's servant gets up in the morning, and when he wakes up, he looks out there in the mountains, and he sees the mountains filled with the enemy army. And he goes to Elisha, and he wakes him up, and Elisha's not worried at all. And this perplexes the servant. He says, but we're doomed. What are we going to do? We're doomed. And if you remember Elisha's prayer, Elisha's prayer was the same as Elijah's prayer when Elisha took his place, was to open his eyes. Elijah wanted Elisha's eyes to be opened so that he could see the chariots of fire. And Elisha said to the servant, or said to God, I pray that you open his eyes. And when he opened his eyes, he saw the army of God surrounding the enemy army. And that's what I pray for us. That's what I pray for the folks in this room. That's what I pray for the battle that we're facing, that everybody in this room, that your eyes will be open to see the power of the one true God who we all claim to profess as the King of the universe, who is in control of all these things. I pray that... Because if we truly believe that, there is nothing that can come against us. I really believe there's not that. How, when you ask a politician, how do you stand up? People ask me all day, how do you stand up for the craziness of the left or the media? It's because I say, I believe that God is who he says he is, that he makes the blood flow through my veins and he puts the air in my lungs every single day. And he chose to put me in office. He can choose to take me out whenever he wants to. But in the meantime, I'm going to fight his battles. I'm going to fight the battles of right and good and truth right here in America. So I'm honored to be fighting alongside you. I really am. I'm thankful that you're here today. I'm thankful that you take part in this. The real question is, then the litmus test is what do we all do when we leave here? There's a lot of great stories. There's a lot of great anecdotes. There's a lot of great speakers. The litmus test is, what do you do? How do you go back and influence your friends? How do you go back and influence your communities, your states, your neighbors, your coworkers? What do you do with this information that you get right here? Because we are at a precipice in America. We're at a precipice, and the leftist insanity has reached a fever pitch, and it's time to stop it. It's time to bring civility back to the world of politics and back to the world of America again, and it's going to start right here with you in this room. So thank you for what you're doing. God bless you all, and I hope you have a great time here.